Welcome. I'm Eric Fleming, host of A Moment with Eric Fleming, the podcast of our time. I want to personally thank you for listening to the podcast. If you like what you're hearing, then I need you to do a few things. First, I need subscribers. I'm on Patreon at patreon.com/A Moment with Eric Fleming. Your subscription allows an independent podcaster like me the freedom to speak truth to power and to expand and improve the show. Second, leave a 5-star review for the podcast on the streaming service you listen to it. That will help the podcast tremendously. Third, go to the website, momenteric.com. There you can subscribe to the podcast, leave reviews and comments, listen to past episodes, and even learn a little bit about your host. Lastly, don't keep this a secret like it's your own personal guilty pleasure. Tell someone else about the podcast. Encourage others to listen to the podcast and share the podcast on your social media platforms, because it is time to make this moment a movement. Thanks in advance for supporting the podcast of our time. I hope you enjoy this episode as well. Hello, and welcome to another Moment with Eric Fleming. I am your host, Eric Fleming. And today I have a couple of authors on to talk about their books. And it's going to be typical of what I try to do, because initially one of the books is very, very, you'll understand the politics of it. The other one, not initially. If you bought this book, you'd be like, where's the politics in this? But once we get into the interviews, and you know me, that I'm going to have people on to discuss things, because politics is in everything that we do. So I hope that you enjoy these guests, and I hope that you get their books after you listen to them on the podcast. But for right now, it is time for A Moment of News with Grace Chi.
Thanks, Eric. The Arizona Supreme Court reinstated a near-total abortion ban from 1864, criminalizing abortions in the state. Donald Trump reemphasized that abortion laws should be left to individual states rather than proposing a national ban. Alan Weisselberg, the former Trump Organization CFO, received a 5-month jail sentence for perjury related to Trump's finances. Donald Trump faced legal setbacks with judges dismissing his attempts to drop charges related to the 2020 Georgia election interference case, the upcoming hush money trial, and holding classified documents. The centrist group No Labels decided not to run a third-party presidential campaign after failing to find a viable candidate. The Biden administration issued rules to protect the jobs of 2.2 million civil servants from being replaced by partisan appointees. The parents of a Michigan teen who killed 4 classmates were sentenced to 10 to 15 years in prison for manslaughter. President Joe Biden announced a plan to ease student debt, which could eliminate accrued interest for 23 million borrowers. The U.S. House has delayed sending impeachment charges against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate. Norfolk Southern agreed to pay $600 million to settle a lawsuit over a toxic chemical spill resulting from a train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. Jacob Wall and Jack Berkman will pay $1.2 million in damages for a robocall campaign that sought to discourage black voters from voting by mail in the 2020 election. New York City agreed to pay a $17.5 million settlement with 2 Muslim American women over forced removal of hijabs by police after arrest. A 4.8 magnitude earthquake hit central New Jersey, close to New York City, causing buildings to shake along the East Coast. A total solar eclipse, the first in North America since 2017, was witnessed by many across the continent with reactions of awe and celebration. And O.J. Simpson, known for his football prowess and legal troubles, died at the age of 76. I am Grace G., and this has been A Moment of News.
All right. Thank you, Grace, as always, for that moment of news. And now it's time for my first guest. And his name is Stephen M. Cohn. Stephen M. Cohn, M.D., is a former surgeon in the U.S. Army Medical Corps in Desert Storm, past division chief of trauma and surgical critical care at Yale University School of Medicine, past medical director of the Ryder Trauma Center in Miami, past chairman of the Department of Surgery at the University of Texas Health Science Center, and current practitioner in New York City. He has also lent his knowledge as an educator and researcher, having produced more than 300 scientific publications, edited 8 surgical textbooks, conducted extensive funded research, participated in many professional organizations, and served as an editorial reviewer for numerous journals. He is the recipient of the Teacher of the Year Awards at Boston University, University of Massachusetts, Yale, and Northwell Health, and a Lifetime Achievement in Education Award from the University of Miami Department of Surgery. He is the author of All Bleeding Stops, Life and Death in the Trauma Unit, which was published by Mayo Clinic Press. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor and privilege to have as a guest on this podcast, Dr. Stephen M. Cohn. All right, Dr. Stephen Cohn, how you doing, my friend? You doing good?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, it's an honor for me to have you on. Because, you know, one of the things I try to do with this show, even though it's a political show, it's not typical in that I'm always going to have elected officials or talking heads or all that stuff. Public policy is determined by people that do the work. And because of your book, All Bleeding Stops, I think it's an important conversation to have as far as what you deal with as a doctor dealing with trauma care and how from a public policy sector, we can make that better. So I really, really want you, I'm really, really honored to have you on. Now, what I'd like to do with guests is that at the beginning, I always throw a quote at them and it may be something they said, something that relates to the work, what have you. So your quote is, "A good surgeon doesn't just concentrate on technical ability, but also on the appropriateness of what you're doing." What does that quote mean to you?
Well, I think a lot of people have the misunderstanding that even though there are some technical aspects of surgery, you know, how we suture up a wound or a blood vessel, that it's mostly a technical skill and not one where it's about the thought process. And let me just turn this off. Sorry. And but the fact is that surgery is mostly about who to operate on, when to operate, and what to do. And unfortunately, or I should say fortunately, the technical aspects of it in most areas of surgery are minimal consequence. So that if you look at 100 surgeons, I always say 3 or 4 of them may be, you know, technical geniuses. And 3 or 4 of them may be unable to, you know, tie their shoes. And in between, everybody's competent enough. That's the process of the training. Everyone's competent enough to get the job done. But it's more about what to do when you're there and whether or not you should be there in the first place. And there's a lot of judgment in surgery. We can't have the attitude, you know, everyone is pre-op or, you know, these kind of, I'm a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail kind of thing. You know, surgeons have to use a lot of judgment. So as you get more senior and you develop a little bit more wisdom based on your experiences, you're a lot less anxious to operate on people the more complicated they are.
Yeah. So what exactly is a trauma surgeon as opposed to any other specific type of surgeon?
Sure. Okay. So a lot of people kind of misconstrue that people that do trauma are emergency room doctors. And emergency room doctors are essential parts of the hospital environment. They take care of everyone who has a stroke or a heart attack or comes in with any kind of bad problem. And sometimes they do some trauma care also. But trauma surgeons are general surgeons who are trained and do a full surgical residency and decided to specialize generally by doing a fellowship. And we take care of all of the really bad surgical emergencies, general surgical emergencies typically. We run the ICUs, and almost always we're at big trauma centers where regionally all the worst car crashes and, unfortunately in this country, gunshot wounds and falls and everything else. People who are really badly hurt are brought by the pre-hospital, you know, paramedics and EMTs to the trauma centers. And we go downstairs to the ER when those folks come in.
When did you realize that that's what you wanted to do, to be a trauma surgeon?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. I know that the world decided when I got to medical school, everyone told me I was going to be a surgeon long before I ever knew that. And then I did my first rotation on surgery, and after like 2 days, I went like, okay, this is it. I get it now. Okay. And then I always sort of gravitated and enjoyed taking care of people that were really sick. And during residency, I got more and more interested in that, and then went on to do a fellowship and have a career. And, you know, I've run a number of trauma centers and surgery departments kind of thing.
Yeah, I understand about the predetermined stuff. My dad and my mom made me take piano lessons because my dad always noticed when I was playing baseball, you got steady hands, you should be a doctor. Needless to say, I didn't follow his advice on that. But I definitely understand that predetermined stuff. And you kind of touched on some of the stuff that's more prevalent in trauma centers as far as gunshot wounds, car accidents. Anything particular you want to add to tell people what you normally see?
Yeah, so let me just say two things specifically about that. One is that people are doing much better because the roads are safer, the cars are safer. The organization, the paramedics and EMTs are better trained. They get people to the hospital faster. You know, we have lots of, you know, great folks out there bringing us the patients fast, you know, and the hospitals are better. Yeah, better equipped, better trained. The nurses and the respiratory therapist, the whole team functions much, much better than it did 40 years ago when I started on all this stuff. Unfortunately, what hasn't changed is the people we're seeing. It's deja vu all over again every time we're on. It's people drunk driving, people not wearing helmets, getting hit by cars, riding around on motorcycles and mopeds. It's people getting shot. And you know, just general high level of violence. People don't realize that the number of folks getting, you know, per capita dying in car crashes related to alcohol, which is about half of them, hasn't changed in the last 35 years with all the efforts that have gone on. We haven't slowed that down. Obviously, I don't have to tell you about gun violence increasing and faster. The number of mass shootings has gone up dramatically. I think last year we had more than two per day over the course of the year. And you guys hear about, or the public, I should say, we all hear about the big ones, the bad ones, the multiple shootings. We don't hear about just the every day this guy got shot through the head, that guy got, you know, injured this way or that way. Those are just a steady stream. We have more people dying related to guns than died in the entire, every year, than died in the entire Vietnam War. That's the volume. It's our country is all by itself in this. None of the other, no other country in the world, certainly not in the developed world, has anything like what we have in terms of gun violence. You know, guns are much more lethal than a knife or a fist.
Well, let's explore that since you brought that up. What are your thoughts about gun violence? What do you think can be done to try to minimize that as far, you know, from your perspective? Is there anything that you can do, even if you can't really think of anything policy-wise to try to minimize it? Is there anything that you think can be done on your end, on the medical end, to try to minimize casualties of it?
Sure. Well, obviously, medically, we've made progress in terms of our knowledge about, how to treat a particular kind of wound. Those things have progressed. So more people with the same wounds may be living now that didn't live 50 years ago, let's say, okay? But unlike, if you said to me, what can we do about making people better with appendicitis? I could say, I happen to know this. As of March 2024, there were almost 29,000 articles written about that. But there's nothing written about gun violence. So I don't really have much. Why is that? Because in 1996, there was a mass shooting in Australia, Tasmania. And in response to that, the country, Australia, put in a bunch of rules and buyback programs, did a lot of different things to try and control their gun availability. And they had not a single mass shooting for the next 20 years. And their number of suicides and homicides dropped dramatically and stayed really, really low. Well, the response in this country was to put through legislation that closed down gun injury section of the CDC, and to make it basically illegal to do research on guns in this country. In other words, if I decided to write a paper or do research as to whether or not it's better to have a gun buyback program or to have a longer period of a wait period before you purchase a gun, or the impact of mental illness or magazine size or assault rifles or any of the things that we might want to study. And there's a long, long list. If I did that, it wouldn't be just me that lost my funding. The university would lose all federal funding, all NIH funding for cancer research, for lung disease, for heart disease and everything. So needless to say, we all stopped doing research in guns, and all the information that we have is from other countries. We don't have any from the United States. There's no information, almost none. And that really ties your hand on how to recommend to the public or to each other, what should we be doing, because we don't really have any information. Now, I believe that recently that was reversed, but for a period of 20, 25 years, nothing, just crickets, just empty space. So I think that there are some obvious things in terms of the public having military type weapons. I mean, I think there's really not much justification for a lot of these different things, but it makes it very difficult for us to be doing the same thing. I work at a safety net hospital. I have done that for most of my career, and still seeing the same problems that we did way back. you know, maybe the gun velocity is a little higher. Also, your public should know that gun violence is a kind of a bimodal thing. It's middle-aged and elderly, rural Caucasian men committing suicide. That's about half. And it's inner city, typically young men of color, involved in homicide. Those are the populations that comprise something like, I don't know, 95% of all the gun deaths are those two populations, a pretty equal number, which is, you know, very unfortunate.
Yeah, it's a tragedy either way. And that kind of explains why it's now being talked about as a public health issue. But, you know, like you said, 20 some years ago, it wasn't, because basically the powers that be said those folks that had those resources in the public health industry couldn't, you know, whether it's in academia or, you know, in the hospitals or whatever, they couldn't do anything to study, or they would lose federal funds. And that's a good point to bring up. Now, when I was in
I'll the... Just say,
go ahead.
Eric, let me say one more thing. Imagine that in 1960, the tobacco industry all got together and they lobbied the Congress, and they put in a regulation that said, if you do any kind of research on smoking and stroke, heart disease, or lung cancer, you're going to lose all your federal funding. That's what happened in 1996. That's what happened in 1996-97 here, is the gun manufacturers went out and bought a whole bunch of congressmen and put this rule in. And we, the community, we're paying the price.
Yeah.
It's awful.
So that gets me to when I was a member of the legislature, right? And I guess, for lack of a better term, I was an advocate for safety. You know, I was pushing for more railroad gates, you know, gate at crossings, at railroad crossings. And, you know, I was an advocate about seatbelt laws and life jackets and motorcycle helmets. When I made my arguments against those who stated that individuals should decide their own safety, I reminded them that the taxpayers paid for the best trauma center in the state. And in Mississippi, that's UMC, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. And so it was best interest of the common good to legislate safety measures. What is your take on that, and why do you have that position?
I'm totally lockstep with you there. I believe the thing that we all, until I was reading about it, I didn't really understand, was that, you know, when you don't wear a helmet, most people don't, for example, they're riding a motorcycle without a helmet. If they crash their motorcycle, they usually don't die. They usually end up vegetative, you know, with minimally responsive in a nursing home. And essentially nobody's insurance pays for that long-term disability. It's all the taxpayers' money, excuse me, that's going to pay for long-term care. And in many cases, it's you run out of your catastrophic medical coverage in just a short period of time. And so even the hospitalization, millions and millions of dollars. So, you know, years ago, folks up in Connecticut looked at, in this small state of Connecticut, what the cost was of not having a helmet law, or would be if they repealed the helmet law. And it was literally multiple billions of dollars a year in that small state in uncompensated medical care. So it isn't a matter, if you don't wear your seatbelt and you end up badly head injured, if you fall off your motorcycle and smack your head and end up in a nursing home, it's not the individual that's covering the cost of that. So it's one thing if you're on a desert island and you want to climb the palm tree and fall, It's just you, you know. But unfortunately, we all in society have to pay for this. So I think these safety measures make a lot of sense. And when it comes to seatbelt laws, people are really compliant. There's a primary or secondary seatbelt law in every state but New Hampshire. And New Hampshire, you know, live free or die is their motto. Last time I checked, they had only a 45% wear rate, and which is terrible. You know, the rest of the states are all well over 90%. Helmet laws are ultimately enforceable because you can't ride past a police officer with a fake head. You know, you either have a helmet on or you don't, you know, and they have huge positive impact. In the book, I had a number of examples of people who had or did or did not wear a helmet. And so it's just really not, it's not a personal choice. You're making a decision that impacts on all of your neighbors and relatives and everyone.
Yeah. And then the other thing is the insurance rates. Because when I was in the legislature, Mississippi had the highest motorcycle insurance rate. And, you know, every year it was a group of motorcycle riders that would come up and they would, it was a particular group of them that would push to make the helmets law. And it just seemed like it was just going through the motions. So the workaround we ended up doing was creating motorcycle safety classes and getting the Department of Public Safety to accreditate those motorcycle safety classes. And people were able to get their rates reduced if they went through one of those classes, because it ended up, I think, three particular organizations set up classes statewide, and that was able to help mitigate the cost until they dealt with the actual helmets. So yeah, it's a public policy thing, and I just, you know, people don't get it. You know, all they get is what they see on Grey's Anatomy or ER, whatever. Which reminds me, because I asked an FBI agent, what does television and movies get wrong about, you know, the FBI and all that? So I'm going to ask you, what do movies and TV shows get wrong about trauma centers?
Most everything, I have to say. The fact is that, you know, it's like in anyone's business, if you were going to try to take whatever any of us does and put it on a 30 or 60 minute television show and keep everyone's interest, it has to be, you know, exciting and entertaining and funny or sad or whatever. And it has to move fast, because if it was depicted in the way that it really is, where everybody's super calm and collected and professional, it just wouldn't sell tickets, you know? So, you know, the trauma center is always depicted as this slam bang, someone's crashing in, they're rolling a guy down the hall from a car crash while someone yells out, he's got a ruptured spleen and a head injury. And like, I don't know how he knows that. The guy's on a stretcher. How does he even know that, right? You just start naming off stuff, prepare the OR, get me 4 units of blood. I mean, that's just not the way it is. There's a very kind of, I won't say it's boring. It's not boring, but there's a very, methodical approach that we have. It's called the ABCs, where we, you know, check their airway and their breathing. And there's a whole language that we use. And honestly, the sicker the person is, the more quiet it should be, and the more calm everyone needs to be. Obviously, the leader has to set the example and remain like a sphinx, very calm and very thoughtful. But anyway, so yeah, there's all kinds of things. We actually talk about the whole TV thing a little bit. And one of the things that always bugs me is like, everybody's always fishing around for bullets, you know, like down a deep hole with a clamp or something, and they pull the bullet out and like, oh, he's saved now. And they drop it in a little can, and it's nonsense. We rarely go and find a bullet. We rarely go fishing for bullets, and we never go down a hole. It might be in the operating room with the belly open that you'd feel the bullet and take it out. But so that's one. The other is that on television, everybody that dies seems to do so in like 10 seconds. people don't usually, you know, it takes you a while, but that wouldn't really be entertaining if, you know, you watch someone, you know, exsanguinate over 15 minutes or something. So, so I think they take liberties, but it's generally done. And the other thing is that people seem to have remarkable abilities. I made the mistake of turning a medical TV show on the other day that one of my friends who's a doctor recommended. And I'm watching as this person makes a diagnosis as usual with no information at all. He just makes a diagnosis. And then the ER doctor goes into the cardiac cath lab and does the cardiac cath. Like, he's not a cardiologist. He can just do anything, right? So we actually have kind of different lanes, and, you know, we all work together. That when it comes to trauma and general surgery, the quarterback is usually the trauma/general surgeon. But, you know, we all have our specific expertise. You know, it's not like one guy knows how to do everything.
Yeah. And you know, in my role in law enforcement, I was assigned to Grady Hospital here in Atlanta. And so I can definitely attest to what you're saying. As a matter of fact, most people coming in, when their loved ones are being brought in, they're expecting the frenetics, and they're like thinking that the doctors are not really caring about their particular loved right. one because they're not panicking. You know what I'm saying? They're just right. calmly doing their thing. And it's like, but y'all got to do something. We're taking care of them, ma'am. Don't worry. You know what I'm saying? So, I definitely can attest to that.
One of my partners was the chief of surgery at Grady.
Okay.
And you know, both of us we both ran, the training centers for military. So when I was in Miami, when he was in LA, he ran the, Navy trauma training center, and I ran the Army one. And basically all the teams, the 24 person teams that would get deployed, they would come through the centers and kind of have a tune up before they left. And, but yeah, so we try to maintain a calmness.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to get to before closing out, there's a couple of questions I want to ask you. But before I get to the ultimate public policy question, in a chapter Managing the Public, you talk about Americans getting bigger, and that sometimes you put patients on diets before surgery. Tell the listening audience why that is important.
Sure. So there is, in my mind, no question that operating on people who are substantially overweight, I don't mean like 10 pounds, I mean they're 100 pounds or more overweight, is much more challenging for the surgeon. Things that would be relatively easy operations become very, very difficult because it's harder to get to the organs that you're trying to deal with. It's harder to fix things or remove things. It's also more stressful on that individual because they often have underlying medical conditions that make them sicker, and just the recuperation phase is harder because it's harder to get them up and moving sometimes, and it puts a lot of stress on wounds, for example, being overweight. And there is a higher risk of infection because there's more adipose tissue. And there's a number of different issues. There's sort of the getting the operation done, and then there's the recovering from the operation. And both those things can be made much more difficult in the patient who is substantially overweight.
Yeah. So that should be encouraging to my folks listening, including myself. You know, it's one thing to get in shape, to try to stay healthy and all that. But if something does happen to you, it'll be a lot easier for you to recover and to be treated if you're more in shape.
Correct.
All right. So now y'all, the doctor confirmed that. So, okay. So let's close this out. What are your hopes for the future of trauma care here in America?
One of my hopes is that we have more folks like yourself advocating for safety measures. Whereas those of us in trauma, we have plenty of work to do. And if we didn't have trauma, we have lots of general surgery patients that are sick, people with appendicitis and gallbladder attacks and colons that are obstructed. We would love to have half the volume of trauma that we see, you know? So I think it's all about injury prevention. And that's what I'm hopeful in the future, that there will be more things, more efforts towards that in the area of cars. Cars are remarkably safer than they were. In 1960, the likelihood of dying per mile driven was 6 per 100,000 miles. Mm. It's now down to like one. Down to one, it's dropped by over 500%. That's amazing, right? But so cars are safer, roadways are safer, we're doing better. You know, some of these obvious safety things, like you mentioned before, like seat belts and helmets, those need to be widely, you know, part of our life. And then when it comes to wounding each other, the lethality, like I said before, of your fist is way, way less than it is from a gun. And we need information. We need to be doing research to better understand what are the kinds of policies that need to be in place to get this under control. Because, you know, we have way too much gun violence in this country. And I'd love to see it be gone.
Is there anything that can be done from the hospital end? Is there anything that you think needs to be done, or you think that the technology has improved and the quality of the staff, the number of people, you know, going to medical school and graduating and getting into profession? Are those things okay, or also things that need to be improved upon?
I don't think there's any question. All those things can be improved upon. I mean, I think that, you know, the quality of education is high. It could be better. The quality of our hospitals is high. They could be better, you know, resource wise. And there are models in the country of real, real excellence. I mean, like, not necessarily more costly, but better use of their money. And, the best example I can think of is like, University of Maryland, Maryland Shock Trauma. In the state of Maryland, which has about 6.5 million people, essentially all the adult trauma goes to one big trauma center, and all the pediatric trauma goes to one big. Now, they have like maybe a couple of smaller trauma centers, but really they've regionalized it and elevated the quality immensely. In contrast, you have places like Boston, where you have 6 trauma centers serving a city of like 750,000 with 8.5 million around it. And you think of how diluted the number of traumas are there relative to in Maryland. So, you know, when I was down in Miami, we were the only trauma center for Miami Metro-Dade. And we were one of the busiest places in the whole country, probably the whole world. Really high level, high quality. And they had a rule that had been put in before I got there, which was that a half-cent sales tax went to pay for Jackson and the trauma center and the helicopter service and everything else, so that we had enough money to take care of things and to take care of the people that couldn't afford it or whatever. And care was really excellent. So I think the regionalization of care could be better. Right now it's kind of financial and politically motivated. I think that there are some areas of the country that could benefit from more trauma centers, and others areas that could benefit from less trauma centers and more regionalization. But I think more efforts should go into injury prevention, safety measures, public awareness, and maybe some intelligent, you know, constriction of the gun availability.
Well, Dr. Cohn, Dr. Stephen Cohn, I am really, really glad that you came on this podcast to talk about this particular issue and to talk about your book. The book is called All Bleeding Stops. You can get that anywhere, I take it?
Yeah. The usual places, Amazon and Barnes and Noble and through the Mayo Clinic Press.
It's a good book. It's a combination you know, where you can see Dr. Cone's expertise in the and his thoughts into the matter. But it's also very entertaining because he's got all sorts of anecdotes. Sounds like him and his family have been trauma patients. Their own.
Unfortunately, yes.
You know, he's got some pretty cool quotes in there. So it's a real good read, y'all. So I encourage y'all to get it. How can people get in touch with you outside of buying the book?
Well, I guess they could email me. I work at St. Barnabas Hospital in Bronx, New York. I don't have a website, so that would have to be the way they get a hold of me. But I'm happy to help anybody that needs it.
And what's the email?
It's smcohn, C-O-H-N, 911@gmail.com.
All right. So Dr. Stephen Cone, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming on. I appreciate you and what you're doing. We didn't even get into talking about COVID and all the drama that you had to deal with there. But, you know, I greatly appreciate your dedication. And like you said, you've been doing this for over 40 years. So just keep up the good work as long as you're willing to do it. And thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Eric. I appreciate it and enjoyed the time with you.
Yes, sir.
Thanks a lot.
All right, guys. And we're going to catch y'all on the other side.
Okay.
All right, and we are back. And so now it is time for my next guest, Saleha Mohsen. Saleha Mohsen is the senior Washington correspondent for Bloomberg News and host of Big Take DC podcast covering policy, politics, and power in Washington, D.C. An Ohio native, she previously lived in Oslo, Norway, and in London. And today we are going to talk about her new book, Paper Soldiers. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor and privilege to have as a guest on this podcast, Saleha Mohsen. All right, Saleha Mohsen. How you doing, ma'am? You doing good?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I am really, really honored to have you because I want to get into your book and hopefully we'll have enough time to do it. But we'll get some things done. But I also want people to kind of understand a little bit about you. So first thing I usually do is offer a quote to the guest, something that they may have written or something that relates to what they're doing. So your quote is, faith in democracy and faith in markets go hand in hand. What does that quote mean to you?
So that is actually one of the lines from former Secretary Bob Rubin from the Clinton era that he wrote after the January 6th insurrection. And it was right around the time that I also was thinking about writing a book on the Treasury Department and on the dollar. And it's the sentence that really helped me hone in to why writing about this agency, the Treasury Department, is so important. Because in that moment, our faith in democracy was being shaken and tested. Because we saw that kind of play out on January 6th in Capitol Hill, on Capitol Hill. And it made me realize that if democracy is under question, then markets that are underpinned by the American financial system are also under some kind of threat. And so when I started writing Paper Soldiers, that's the overarching narrative. One of the overarching narratives of the book, that we need a strong democracy to maintain the faith in markets that gives our country so much economic and geopolitical strength. And all of that is kind of underpinned in the dollar.
So is that, was that your main motivation for writing a book?
It was one of the key ones. It was one of the ones that triggered the way I started thinking about the Treasury Department's importance in our daily lives, in how we are able to at least pursue, if not achieve, the American dream.
Okay. Now, I want to ask you a personal question before we get back into the book. Why did your mom say to you at the age of 15, I think you're going to be a journalist?
That's a great question. Yeah. And, you know, the funny thing is that when my mom said that to me, I kind of rolled my eyes and thought, oh, well, you don't know me very well, like a teenager would. Look, I wasn't great at math. Science was hard for me. But I did show a writing talent from a pretty young age. In fifth grade, I won this essay contest. If you remember DARE, the anti-drug program from the 90s,
yeah.
They had a contest. I entered it because I wanted the free teddy bear, the award that was the teddy bear. Won the award. And then in eighth grade, so when I was about 13 or 14, I wrote an essay and the teacher really liked it. She kind of held it up to the class as the standard of which we should be writing in. And I think my mom kind of realized, as mothers do, now I have a teenager of my own, that you should cultivate this talent. And here is one job that could work for you.
Yeah. And you've had a pretty interesting life, but we won't get into all of those details. But I did want to get that question in there. A lot of the questions I'm going to ask you kind of lean toward my love for history, right? So why was America referred to as Hercules in a cradle? And what does Bretton Woods, New Hampshire have to do with that?
Yeah. So when the country was first established in the 1770s, there was a lot of the world, you know, many of the world powers at the time were looking at America, thinking this tiny little new democracy, it's a couple of colonies that broke off from Britain, it's not even going to last, right? Everyone kind of just kept waiting it out, thinking at some point they're just going to fall back into the British Empire. They were ruling the world. Their currency was the supreme. Their economy was the largest and supreme. And so, and this new foundling nation with such big talk, but also kind of exciting. There was so much hope and excitement about what was happening. And then the states were expanding and economic growth through the 1800s was booming. In 1880, the US overtook Great Britain in economic size. And so it really was about to become Hercules, but you kind of knew from its infancy that it was either gonna be huge or it was gonna go bust very quickly. Bretton Woods, this is right toward the end of World War II. The economic policymakers of 44 allied countries came together in the U.S. to create a new economic brotherhood so that the world was so deeply integrated that we wouldn't go to war with each other and there wouldn't be world wars, because this was the second one back-to-back that the world had faced. And by design, the U.S. currency was crowned King Dollar to be at the center of the global financial system of all commerce and trade. And that is just the moment that the U.S. was no longer in the cradle. It was the largest by economic size and also now the steward of the world's most important asset.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I've tried to stress on my show and throughout my political career. When people talk about why does the United States have to have all this international involvement, I explained to them that was the deal we made after World War II. We agreed to be the policemen of the world, and we agreed that the dollar would be the basis of currency in the world. So I'm just glad I got somebody smarter than me to validate that. How revolutionary of an idea was the concept of paper money? Not backed by gold or any other precious metal, but by the full faith and credit of the United States government.
Yeah, what you're referring to is a concept from the 1860s, right when the US was in the midst of the Civil War. Treasury's coffers were empty. We needed cash. The country needed cash. And so the Treasury Secretary, Salmon P. Chase, saw a little bit of a wild idea someone had proposed, that we should have a paper currency that's just backed by credit. That, yeah, if you need the gold, we'll give it to you, or we'll give you goods for it for in exchange for this piece of paper. And there was a lawmaker who called it, quote, immoral. That to have a piece of paper rather than a commodity like a metal, silver, gold created by God, underpinning currency, that just seemed wild. That paper can be burned up, and it, you know, at the time, it's kind of like we're seeing this new country, still not 100 years old. Maybe this is going to be the moment of demise when they create this paper currency.
Right, and. The big momentum was during the Civil War, I guess, with Mr. Chase as the treasurer. That was kind of the scenario.
Yeah, that's when he realized that he needed to do something creative, to find a way to print some money to keep the war efforts going. And it actually helped the North. It assisted the North in winning, because very quickly the Southern states that had a couple of different currencies in play started using the Northern dollar currency. The first time it was printed, you know, green on one side, without quite the sophisticated watermarks and everything that we have and need now. But that infiltration of that currency into the South helped to tip the scales as the North started to win.
So you mentioned in the book that one of our U.S. treasurers, James Baker, failed an economics exam. I barely survived my econ class, so I need you to break down some things to me and my audience. One, what are the pros and cons of a strong U.S. dollar?
So a strong U.S. dollar, there's two definitions to a strong dollar. The first one is dollar hegemony. So it's centrality in the world, that everyone needs the dollar in order to engage in global commerce. That's one definition. The one that we're going to talk about now is the definition of its exchange rate value. So how many goods it can buy in a foreign country, or how many goods we can sell to someone purchasing in a foreign currency. So a strong exchange rate for the dollar is good for American consumers in a couple of different ways. The key one being that then we are able to, as American consumers, buy more overseas goods. American consumers drive the U.S. economy, which drives the global economy. So our purchasing power is stronger. We can buy more goods because we get more foreign goods because we have a strong exchange rate. So anyone selling anything in Japanese yen or the Vietnamese dong or the Chinese yuan, we can buy more of it. Now, the negative side also has to do with the American manufacturing sector and the consumer, because a strong exchange rate for the dollar means that the American export industry, American made goods, struggle in markets to sell their goods. If you think about it, in the early 2000s and teens, Walmart didn't stock a lot of made in America goods because they were too expensive to buy. And foreign countries also weren't buying American made goods because the dollar was so strong, they couldn't afford those goods. And so the negative is that you have a bunch of states that used to thrive. You had local economies that were company towns built up around manufacturing, and those plants and factories rusted. And so amazing places like Ohio, which is where I'm from, and Pennsylvania and West Virginia became called the Rust Belt states.
Right. And you tell the story about a particular company that had been one of the largest tin steel making companies in the world, and how the strength of the dollar had a negative impact on that particular company. And that's an aspect, you know, that a lot of people, regular people, don't understand. But yeah, just kind of expound real quick on that particular instance.
So in the town of Weirton, West Virginia, you had a company that made, if anyone in the 60s or 70s, you pull out a tin can, canned peaches, canned beans, whatever, that tin was most likely made in Weirton, West Virginia. And so that town was built around that economy. You had people who worked in the factory, and then those people needed to go to the grocery store, get their cars fixed, buy a car, buy clothes, have dinner out, go to the movie theater. So that whole economy, it was a company town, was built up around this. And slowly, as steelmaking moved overseas because it was cheaper to produce the product overseas, then American jobs started to disappear, that those plants needed to shut down. They couldn't keep up. Those companies didn't have enough cash on hand to invest in upgrading infrastructure and technological advances that other that companies, similar companies in other countries were able to tap into. So they slowly just got further and further behind the curve.
So the very first chapter of the book is entitled Surviving Donald Trump. We understand we survived his style of governing and his handling of the pandemic and January 6th. What did America survive as it relates to the U.S. dollar?
Yeah, the president, President Trump, he really did hear the cries and realize that there was so much economic scarring in parts of America that had been ignored for a long time. And so he realized that a weaker exchange rate would actually be a quick fix and a necessary fix for these companies. And so he talked about intervening in the currency, about aggressively using government cash to affect the rules of supply and demand of the dollar. And that would actually shake the world's faith in the currency that underpinned so much of global trade. And so that would is that sort of politicization of it, the dollar would actually not be good for the country itself. And in the first chapter, I lay out how Steven Mnuchin actually was the person who kind of stood in the way, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin at the time, stood in the way of some of those instincts that Trump had.
And, you know, to be fair and to be transparent, that's probably the first positive thing I've ever heard about Steve Mnuchin during my time. And that you're a reporter, you deal with these folks on a daily basis. But to read that he stood in the gap to make sure that Trump didn't overreact, which he tends to do, in my opinion. And basically he did his job to make sure that the dollar remained viable and stable.
Yeah, and in the book, I do lay out that that plan did not go outside of the Oval Office. So Trump did not take any further steps, was not able to and did not take any further steps. But he did very seriously consider it. And after decades of the U.S. trying to maintain a very stable rhetoric and activities and dialogue and economic diplomacy around currency policy, it would have been very, very disruptive.
All right. So the part of the book that's gotten you the most attention is dealing with how the U.S. dollar is weaponized when it comes to sanctions. So explain that process. And in your opinion, are sanctions effective for the most part?
Yeah, the dollar, it was 9/11 when the U.S. kind of really honed in on the fact that the dollar gives the U.S. the power to export its own foreign policy and geopolitical objectives. When the Twin Towers came down, 2 weeks later, George W. Bush came to the Rose Garden and he stood next to his Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill, and he told the world that at midnight the night before, with the stroke of a pen, he launched the war on terror. Now, that launch did not start with a military tank rolling into a foreign country. It started with economic sanctions and the Treasury getting unique authorities to track financial footprints to see how was it that terrorists were able to finance that attack, and how can we choke off access to money for these terrorists so that they can't finance anymore, or how can we see the way they're using the global financial system, the way they are using and maybe abusing the dollar in order to engage in these malign activities that threaten American national security, our borders, and global security. And since then, the U.S. has turned to to sanctions more and more because it is a space between war and words. By words, I mean diplomacy. When talking to another country over disagreements fail, often the next step has been war, kinetic action. But with sanctions, you have this very large space in between that you can slowly tighten like a vise to force another country or an adversary to change its alleged bad behavior. And that's been used to sort of curtail nuclear programs and other things and humanitarian problems. And now we saw, you know, in 2022, in February 2022, that the U.S. led the world in imposing the harshest sanctions ever seen on Russia. And those sanctions, it's been 2 years. I get asked a lot, like you said, about the efficacy of those sanctions. And the way I look at it is actually that sanctions, okay, so yes, the sanctions came down. For a while, it was really painful for the Russian economy, and it was actually painful for the American economy because our gas prices did go up when all that Russian oil had to come off markets. Russia adjusted. It basically transformed from a regular economy to a war economy. And China and a couple of other countries have helped Russia survive way more than I think the U.S.-led coalition initially had expected. What people forget is that when the war started, there was thinking in the U.S. intelligence community that it's a 72-hour operation and Kyiv could fall. And 2 years later, the war is ongoing, yes, but Kyiv has not fallen. On the other hand, you can't ignore the fact that Russia has imported $1 billion worth of microchips from the U.S. and from Europe that supports its war technology, and that's all without violating sanctions. So the thing is, though, that sanctions are a tool, not a policy. So you can say that the U.S.'s foreign policy has succeeded or failed, but to say it, the sanctions failed is kind of like saying my house fell apart, the hammer failed.
I got you. All right. So a common question that is asked of you is how the current state of American politics is impacting the U.S. dollar now. So I'll ask that as well. And also I want to ask you, how hopeful are you that the U.S. dollar will remain strong in the immediate future?
Yeah, I'm glad you're asking this question about hope. So I do like to highlight that there's a lot of foreign threats that people talk about. Russia, a China-led coalition, other countries coming together and trading in their currencies jointly outside of the U.S. dollar. And if that means, oh, de-dollarization, the power has waned or flattened. But what I think and what I see is that no foreign threat is going to be as bad for American dominance and dollar dominance as our domestic problems. Because in order to address our biggest threat to our superpower status and the dollar's centrality, we need to bring down our deficit. It's at $34 trillion right now. You cannot possibly bring that down unless you have bipartisanship in Congress. Right now, we have a Congress, they can't agree on what color the sky is. They see different shades of blue, green, and pink, I think. So, so until we can come together, you know, we will continue to look uncertain overseas. Now, the reason I'm hopeful is that one, we're a strong democracy. We are so because we're not afraid to become very self-critical. And while it feels really painful, we're in that moment now. It's very nasty. We've been here before in previous decades. In our 200-year history, we've had some very ugly moments. They play out in the world stage. And at some point, we fix it and we come out stronger. So I do have hope that as long as we're a strong democracy, We can maintain rule of law, independent institutions, free and fair elections. We can continue to be a leader in the world. And actually, I have a factoid just from today's markets to point to that reveals that the U.S. dollar remains important and remains a strong world reserve asset. If you look at the markets right now, there is some angst everywhere that Iran could strike against Israel. And because of that, investors are fleeing to the dollar because it is a safe haven. And that right there shows that when there is crisis, people still trust in the dollar, its credibility, its integrity, the government that backs it, because it is still a dominant currency.
So I think Paper Soldiers should be required reading for every business and finance major in the United States. Having said that, how can people get your book? And also, how can people get in touch with you other than watching you on Bloomberg News?
So the book is called Paper Soldiers, How the Weaponization of the Dollar Changed the World Order. It's available wherever you can buy books and audiobooks, your favorite retailer, Amazon, Books a Million, all the independent places that you can get books. And I am frequently on Twitter and LinkedIn. That is the best way to get my attention.
All right. So Saleha Mohsen, I am so honored that you were able to take the time off your schedule to come on the podcast, talk about this book, and talk about something that a lot of people need to understand, that is more than just certain issues that you see, but there's some other things that are going on. And if you read this book, you'll understand there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes. So I appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast. Thank you.
I appreciate you having me on.
All right, guys, and we're going to catch y'all on the other side. All right, and we are back. So I just want to thank Dr. Cohn and Ms. Mohsen for taking time out of their busy schedules, not just in promoting their books, but also as far as their day-to-day lives. As you heard, Dr. Cohn was getting calls while we were doing the interview. I mean, he is a doctor for all practical purposes. And, you know, Ms. Mohsen, I'm really, really honored and thrilled that she took the time to put our podcast on her schedule, because her book is like one of the New York Times best-selling books already. And she's basically been on demand. So again, I'm honored for both of them to come on, and I hope that y'all got something out of that. O.J. Simpson passed away as we were putting this show together, and you heard Grace mention it in the news thing. And I did something on that. I basically stated my opinion about his life and times on Patreon. So if you want to hear what I have to say, subscribe to patreon.com/AMomentWithEricFleming. And I had something to say. So anyway, y'all do that. Y'all keep listening to the podcast, and until next time.